Under sub two of our draft, we set out, a person commits theft if, with intent to avoid payment therefore, he obtains services which are available only for compensation by force, threat, deception, or other means. Now, I would think that you're hypothetical that an individual who uses a credit card.
I mean, using his own credit card now.
Oh, if it's his own credit card and it's a valid credit card, there wouldn't be any.
You'd have to have the element of deception
involved, and intent to defraud.
That's what I was getting.
Oh, yeah. But now the Model Penal Code quotation from their 10-day draft 2 states that there's widespread legislation imposing minor penalties for particular instances of cheating and obtaining service. For example, obtaining service from hotels and restaurants without intent to pay, dropping slugs and coin machines. But in general, it is no crime to induce a doctor, engineer, or lawyer by false representations to render services since no, quote, profit, unquote, is obtained. Now, our commentary, we cite an Oregon case, State versus Miller, a 1951 case, which, for the purposes of the false pretense statute, property was defined as that it must be something capable of being possessed and title of which can be transferred. And, of course, our definition of services would provide protection for someone who provides services to somebody in the form of labor or in the form of accommodations. And the person receiving these services or accommodations has an intent. I would like to make that clear. There is a mens rea element in this crime. There has to be an intent to avoid payment. And we have then enumerated the different methods by which an individual can, if he has such an intent, commit the crime of theft of services. If he obtains these services by either force or threat or deception or other means. But Oregon is no exception to the general rule that Model Penal Code draftsman is referred to, and that there are isolated instances, a few cited here, unlawful riding on a train, interference with water rights appliances, gas and electric appliances, interference with telegraph equipment service, interference with coin telephone, defrauding an innkeeper, obtaining taxicab transportation by fraud. We even have a statute crossing a toll bridge without paying is a crime. Defrauding a stable keeper is a crime. Obtaining communication services by fraud, possessing or using a device to obtain service from a coin telephone or machine without depositing a coin. These are some examples of present statutes that cover this type of conduct. certainly, if you have an individual who pays for something with a credit card, if he has no intent to avoid payment,
let me point out one more thing generally with respect to this. I think as Don pointed out, we had more trouble with this section than anyone that we've had in the arson, which we're presently wrestling with, and which after Bruce Wally gets back from the Oxbow fire case, we might have a lot more trouble with. But some of the codes have just prima facie made it criminal for refusing to pay. And we felt that there should be an overt act. And so we got down here to subsection 3, where we employ the use of the word absconding. And there was great discussion standing over about 3 meetings as to whether we were going to leave absconding in. And in the minutes of May 17, there is some discussion about this, where we recite absconding requires an overt act. Now, in the wisdom of the subcommittee, if you go into the prime rib and buy dinner, and walk out the front door and get your car driving away, that would not be absconding within the meaning of our theft of services statute. But if you go into the men's room and climb out the window, or use stealth or some similar
you sneak out the front door.
Well, I think Spaulding was very careful to use that example about climbing through the men's room window. Wanted to get the legislative history of this song. It's not a constitutive scorning. So it must be clear that we're not talking about an ordinary instance of forgetting to pay. And you might want to look make reference to those minutes. We have two other things. If you look at preliminary drafts 2A and 2B, you'll see where we considered for a time going to the New York Penal Code and adopting their theft of services statute, which recites this with great specificity. They go on for a page and a half reciting the instances in which a person would be guilty of theft of services, and what would constitute prima facie evidence and so on. We also consider just a recodification of the present Oregon statute on bribing an innkeeper, but we felt that if we went to that, then we would have to unduly broaden and extend the statute in order to bring within its scope 15 other present ORS sections which also relate to theft of services. We settled on this preliminary draft 3 with the uneasy feeling that maybe the commission would bandy it about. But in order to get into the substance of it, let's look at section 1, the definitions. And I'm not going to recite them, but do you have any discussion with respect to these definitions? Is there anything that you think should be included, or anything that you think should be deleted? And let's approach it from that manner.
I have a question about the last line, subsection 1. I take it that you are suggesting that there might be other commodities of a public utility nature besides the four you have mentioned. If there are other types of services, let's say garbage, for example, or milk, which in some sense has a public utility phase, that you may be asking for trouble in the language which you have used of supplying commodities of a public utility nature such as gas, electricity, steam, and water. For example, if you don't pay your garbage bill, let's say, or whatever it might be. I'm just checking the statute as to what a public utility is under the utility section of the statute. That isn't much help, frankly, but they're looking at a different phase of PUC commission statute. If you intend to encompass commodities other than the four specified, I think you are leaving it vague. If, on the other hand, you're content to limit it to the four named, then you do not need the phrase commodities of public utility nature. But I'm sure that with our developing scientific technique and so on, there are going to be other types of commodities or services of a public utility nature, which you might well want to bring in this section. But
Jim, do you think it makes much difference, particularly when section 2 goes on, here's what you must do before you are guilty of theft of services? And it would apply to garbage as well as it would to anything else.
I'm querying, would it apply to garbage?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, because it would be labor.
Yes.
The
it could.
Can't hear you, Captain.
He was saying including, but not limited to, and I think we're still running to your
Mr. Mayor.
We were just discussing, for instance, community television cable systems, sneaking in a connection on that, for instance. Well, it's a public utility in a sense, but it's not regulated as such at this point in the game. Yes, right. And so you could have a changing definition.
Well, one of the reasons for this, as I recall, was that very thing. We don't know what's going to develop in this sign.
We didn't want to limit it to these. These are the ones that you'd ordinarily think of. Talk about public utilities, but
we haven't gotten into the general principles. But as you know, traditionally the courts are reluctant to. Courts are likely to apply the rule of strict construction. Even though you may have statutes that say you don't apply the rule of strict construction.
Well, that happened because it followed the courts, not this
commission. I'm trying to save everybody a lot of problems in the future. I think simply that if at a later date you want to prosecute a theft of service that doesn't fall specifically within those four classes, you would have trouble doing so with that language. Assuming two and three are complied with, still would garbage or community television or so on be, that might fall into the communication service part, I don't know, but...
You don't think the word such as would
well,
be clear?
Well, I think you'd have the same problem of the rule of, which I can never pronounce, Kathleen.
Yes, considerous?
Yeah. Comes up in subsection 2 also. You're still going to have that rule of construction, that problem.
We had
John, I think the two gentlemen here have their hands up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was going to say that I think this is an excellent place for legislative history to take its place here in our discussion, and I agree. I don't particularly like to see those four specifications there stopping. After nature leaves a very serious question, of course, of what a public utility, what public utility nature means, but I think that advertence by the courts to our minutes, which would then clearly show that we need garbage and cable television and gas, heat, steam, and so forth, would remove perhaps this problem. This would perhaps solve the problem. I agree with the judge. I think that putting these four in, specifically in the statute, may be unnecessarily limiting.
Dave.
I think it's already been said that the public utility nature down here in those four categories, then you have up here transportation telephones, which probably would be considered utilities themselves too. I think you're going against yourself there by adding those four.
Except in line with the legislative history, there are statutes right now that talk about public utilities such as gas, electricity, steam, and water, and then other separate statutes which talk about communication service and telephones specifically. We would certainly entertain a motion to amend this as suggested.
Mr. Chairman, including but not limited to possibly the better language.
Then we'd be using it twice, so when you say,
oh, that's right.
You've already got it.
Yeah.
Services include, but it's not limited to.
Yeah.
Now, the Model Penal Code language is they define services which include, among others, a telephone or other public service. And as far as public services are concerned, they stop that.
Your point. Was that having already delineated transportation or telephone by employing the phrase and term public utility nature, it's a redundancy.
If not eliminating these other broad terms we have on the line 3 here, line 3 or 4. In other words, if you're, say, toll facilities, transportation, public utilities, perhaps eliminate telephone or other communication services. Be broad enough to cover that. But you're trying to broaden it, aren't you, rather than narrow it down?
I would say this, however. If you put in the words, including but not limited to, after the word nature, and then take out the word such as, I think you solve most of the problems. The fact that you use that same phrase twice in the same section may be a grammatical heresy, so that after, put a comma after nature and just use the words including but not limited to, gas, electric, and so on, take out the word such as. Then you leave it open for other public utilities to come within the framework. Revert back up to your telephone or communication services.
Jim, how would this sound? Services include, but is not limited to, labor, professional service, toll facilities, entertainment, supplying of food, lodging, or other accommodations in hotels, restaurants, or elsewhere, the supplying of equipment for use, transportation, telephones, other communication services, and supplying of commodities and supplying of public utility services, period. Then that would put it would retain the distinction that exists between utilities and telephone and communication services, but it would place public utilities as we know them in the same position. I'll read that again. Services include, but is not limited to, labor, professional service, toll facilities, entertainment, supplying of food, lodging, or other accommodations in hotels, restaurants, or elsewhere, transportation, telephone, and the supplying of public utility services.
You forgot the time you left that.
Equipment for use.
Well, I meant and equipment for use as
well.
Services include, but is not limited to, labor, professional service, toll facilities, entertainment, supplying of food, lodging, or other accommodations in hotels, restaurants, or elsewhere, the supplying of equipment for use, transportation, telephone, other communication services, and the supplying of public utility services.
Well, what do you mean then? What would you mean then by public utility services?
Well, the model penal code has it in that way. We would know that gas, electricity, steam, and water would be.
I'm not so sure about that. We might, in the absence of a definition in here, we might be remitted to the definition in the public utilities code.
Supposing then,
if we want to
public utility services such as gas, electric, steam, and water.
I don't have any background in law. I'm sort of fine about getting my pants on. I tend to feel that the dead burn suggestion would be the most workable. And I feel, for instance, that I was thinking about the community television cable, but I think that fits under either
toll
facilities or entertainment. It's got some of all those things, so it's covered, I think, already. As far as gravity is concerned, how about the transportation there? I hate to leave out electricity. Again, it's a matter of lack of experience. I think that a guy once stuck a jumper on a public service company's brain. I just hate to leave out electricity and water and these things. Now, there's a difference maybe between commodities that's used here and services that center your theory. That the service might be just hooking up and not involve the actual water or electricity. I kind of think that this is the seat of the pen. That Vern's suggestion would do it.
But that gets to
from a statutory drafting standpoint, Kathleen, the employing that same descriptive phrase twice, what about it? Is it constant problem?
Well, grammatically, it's somewhat of a... But aside from that, my only problem is that I'm not sure that changing from including but not limited to, or I mean, such as to including but not limited, has gotten around the original objection that you're still falling into the use of generis application. I don't know whether courts may have said it because you use including but not limited to instead of such as, which in common parlance would be, might be argued to mean just about the same thing.
Well, we have the commission intent, I think, rather clearly spelled out, as George pointed out, in our minutes. Here's a novel idea. Why not leave it as it is?
My only suggestion is, Mr. Chairman, would be that let's make awfully sure that you have a real good index on those minutes. Then it's fine discussion when they're looking at that section.
I think we're going to need that in presentation of this to the legislature anyway.
Carrying out your thoughts, Senator, it still disturbs me. I believe that the rule would have to be the language of the statute would prevail over any legislative history. If, in fact, there is language that causes doubt in with respect to the application of the statute, it would have to prevail. If it's not there at all, then the court is completely free to revert to the legislative history. It seems to me an unnecessary conflict be built in by leaving the language there.
Well, that was my intent originally when I used public utility services.
Well, I'd just like to say this, I know when this was first drafted, when we first started discussing this area, I don't think any of us had in the back of our minds the question of garbage services and this type of thing. What we were concerned about and what this was directed at was specifically, certainly, gas, electricity, and the public utilities, well, to use for want of a better phrase, this type of service that is covered specifically in statutes now, interference with gas and water appliances and that type of thing. We wanted to make it clear that we were including those types of services within this draft, and that I think that we felt that the rest of our definition of services was broad enough to include and to encompass other types of services that would be rendered, whether you call them public utility service or something else, that we felt that when we say that services includes but is not limited to these enumerated things, that although we specifically then at the tail end of our definition referred to gas, electricity, steam, and water, we did not feel that we were leaving out anybody. What you say they were going to come into, you're going to call them, if you're going to call a garbage man and someone who performs a public utility service twice, but if you don't, then we felt that, at least I felt that our definition was broad enough to protect that kind of individual because he would be it within the other definition.
It would seem to me that when we're talking about the commodities of a public utility nature, we're talking about there, we're using the term commodities. So we're talking, at least today in this day and age, we're talking about these types of things such as electricity, whatever it is, that it causes something to move this gas, water, steam. These things that have been named, and if in later times some other type of commodity is developed, such as atomic power or something like this, if the court's rules don't come within this, I mean, if they're going to restrict the authority to just these four things, well, then let the legislature act. Of course, we don't want to prepare statutes that are going to need amending.
We're going to make mistakes, no matter what we do, there will be amendments anyway.
Yeah. So I agree with the chairman, the front, at least for now, and we can go into all these possible theories of things, but I think that the wording as it is now is probably as satisfactory as we can make it at this time.
I was wondering the feasibility of saying and the supplying of public utilities such as are now or may hereafter be regulated by any governmental agency. I wondered originally if you'd say they're now regulated by the Public Utility Commission, but there are others like sewage, the community television, any number of this kind of thing that are regulated by cities, public utility districts, one kind or another, and so on, that it would include, by including those that are regulated by some form of a governmental agency, almost any of the kind of thing that we're talking about.
Would you have any, I suppose not, would you have any problem where, because it would be regulated, where a city gives a franchise to a private individual or a company for garbage haul in that city. Now, in those franchises, of course, there are regulations, so that would be regulated, wouldn't it? That might be a solution.
I assume now, I don't know whether taxi cabs are regulated by the Public Utility Commission, but I'm sure taxi cabs are regulated by practically all cities.
This comes from transportation.
Yeah.
My opinion, would be a clear case of open-ended criminality, which I think is something that ought to be avoided by this commission if possible. We're inviting then cities to regulate and make a crime something that was not, that could not perhaps conceivably be in the mind of this commission when it enacted this statute. And furthermore, I think another difficulty with that would be is that you could commit a crime in Eugene that would not be a crime in Salem.
True.
So there would be open-ended criminality and non-uniformity of application. I wonder if that's a very good
answer. I think we have it about as well as we fight it all day.
John, could I just ask a very fundamental question that probably is not an answer to other people? Would there be a possibility for prosecution if there was a situation where somebody went into a prime rib and after sitting there for 45 minutes, got up to leave and they served the food, he said, "I'm not going to pay because I waited 45 minutes and I can't sit down and eat it now."
No,
because he wouldn't have paid the services.
Well, but he's
under 2A.
Yeah, you've got to have the intent to avoid payment to start out with. I mean, it's the same like
that's precisely why the subcommittee decided to eliminate some of the other prima facie provisions from this draft, because I think Michigan and New York both include a refusal to pay is a prima facie, or a presumption is raised in the project intent. And we felt that we wanted to stay away from that because that your example is a good one, because the same example was brought up in the subcommittee. What if you get rotten service or you get a rotten, lousy meal in this restaurant? Should this be prima facie evidence of the project intent? The subcommittee felt no, it shouldn't be. That's why it was limited to signing without payment.
In that instance, he wouldn't have intended to avoid payment, he wouldn't have paid services. And, all right, do we have a motion then with respect to sub 1?
I move we approve sub 1 for circulation.
Is there a second?
Second.
Motion to approve second that we approve sub 1 for circulation. All in favor, signify by saying
aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried. Now, further discussion with respect to subsection 2.
I have just, maybe it's because of having read the statutes that have so dang many commas in them that it's sometimes kind of difficult, like this one we've got here, section 1, that sometimes it's hard to delineate where it's a real comma. You know, I don't know what the English term would be for it, but it seems like it might be clear if we had the obtained by force, threat, deception, or other means services which are available only for compensation. Period, rather than compensation, comma, by force, comma, threat, comma, and deception. I mean, that it doesn't make any great deal of difference, but
Put theory out of conversation.
Well, if he, rather than put obtained services which are available only for compensation, comma, by force, comma, threat, comma, deception, comma, the way it is now, obtained by force, comma, threat, comma, deception, comma, or other means, services which are available only for compensation. I mean, does that, it doesn't have...
I wonder if we're splitting hairs.
Yeah, I think that probably it is, but they make no...
We made a fundamental decision, I think at the previous commission meeting, that recognizing that our drafting wasn't perfect, we were going to try to deal with the substance, and our tentative drafts were going to have to be dramatically polished up by legislative council, and that in the interest of time we ought to defer to their judgment, since we have their A number one girl with us. She'll bear that in mind.
Would you please know that I marked my already marked my calendar the same way you do.
I have a question on the phrase or other means. Do we not again have a problem? You've spent quite a bit of time in the subcommittee on this, and I'm reluctant to raise it, but I do so further to complicate the legislative history. But whenever you see that phrase, of course, the lawyers and judges get jumpy about it.
Hey, there's something in the minutes concerning that very thing. Donna, do you want to pick that up? There was considerable discussion with respect to we that. Discussion, Mr. Foley moves that, quote, with intent to defraud, in quote, be inserted after the if in sub 1, so that the intent to defraud would modify the other meanings and thus require theft by other fraudulent means. The motion carried, but was later withdrawn, and Mr. Fleck pointed out that with intent to fraud was not consistent with by force. And inasmuch as the intent to fraud was intended to modify other means only and not to modify force, threat, deception, Mr. Spaulding withdrew his previous motion and moved adoption of the following. I remember this meeting where we withdrew all the motions. Well, down to this.
The promise is admissible favors.
Yeah, it's an act. I like a notice Harkin's choice of words. In the last meeting, he said, Mr. Spaulding, in a spirit of compromise, moved.
Actually, what does by other means add? We
other fraudulent means is what it means.
Notice that the model penal code uses other means to avoid payment.
I'm not trying to rehash the battle that you fought in subcommittee, because I'm satisfied that the result you got there was proper and a good resolution of it. But the point I want to raise is still that whenever you see these words, you're going to run into this general rule of construction. And as much as we can, I think we ought to avoid it, because all it does is create trouble.
I think the other means
dramatically, it means some other means to obtain, some other means.
Employment of other means to avoid payment.
With intent to avoid payment, which can open intent to avoid payment. But I suspect that when it comes down to it, the court is going to say that the means that unless it is committed by force or by threat or by deception with the requisite intent to avoid payment, that you do not have a crime.
Well, let's know they can't.
At
now, when we're talking about gas, electricity, steam, water, they seem like force, threat, deception. We've got the violent type, and also the deception, the sneaky type. So when the other means, it adds more to it than the such as in the gas, electricity, this type thing, because they're the.
What about the man who climbs out the bathroom window? What deception is it? There's no force, there's no threat.
No.
Is that deception?
It's another means of endeavoring to avoid payment.
Yeah, that's what I was.
Well, I appreciate that, but you can have all the legislative history in the world, and as I think Professor Platt pointed out a few moments ago, you're still running into 3 or 4 centuries of judicial rigidity, if you want to call it that. When you see the phrase, or other means, they're going to say, It is limited to the specified descriptive phrases which may be preceded.
Well, all right, Jim, what if it were to say if a person in any manner with intent to defraud or intent to avoid payment obtained services and so on, didn't mention force, threat, or deception at all, what would the court say then?
They'd
say that's no crime.
They'd probably have some other complaint.
Mm-hmm.
But, I suspect that if you want to make it a crime, climb out the window. This makes sense in the context of what we're working toward, but I'm not at all sure that you're going to find a court that would say that that's a crime with this phraseology. And I hate to see us adopt phraseology that we think is going to cover a situation and then run into a historic rule of construction that'll just show you right back out.
Would action satisfy you as a substitute for meaning?
Well, the word other is the one that triggers the rule of construction.
Would the adding the phrase, and it makes a little redundancy, but or other means to avoid payment, by fraud, deception, or other means to avoid payment, would that cover the finding out the window? Pretty apparent that it's a means to avoid payment when you're going down the back door.
No, I think the grammar that you produced makes it clear that that you're to punish any other means that accompany the requisite intent. Maybe I'm missing it. I'd like to hear what Justice Sloan.
Well, I have the same
miles.
I have the same problem you have with.
I've never been too happy with that rule of construction, because a lot of the time it pinches in on you. A lot of the time you're very happy with it, depending on which side of the fence you're on. But it's a very well established rule.
What if we were to say, or leaves the premises with intent to escape payment?
This gets back into your step 7.
Maybe you just can't get there from here.
Now, you, Justice Sloan, well remember this particular subcommittee meeting, and the various drafts and redrafts that we employed in effort to make it crystal clear that the other means relate solely to other means of attempting or intending to avoid payment. And looking at it in that context, as we've recited here, with intent to avoid payment, a person commits theft if, with intent to avoid payment, therefore, he obtains services which are available for compensation by force, threat, deception, or other means. Isn't it clear that the other means relates back to that intent, and in court would so construe it?
It's crystal clear that the other means must be other means which possess the requisite intent, namely to avoid payment. But it doesn't solve the problem, in my opinion, of getting around the rule of construction.
Well, Jim, is this rule of construction unique already?
No.
Well, then how does it happen that the Model Penal Code, the New York, Michigan, and all of the other states have adopted this type of language?
Maybe we can cover it in the general sections by throwing out a lot of these sometimes artificial rules of construction. I think some of the other codes do that by prescribing rules.
Or we could put a sentence in the minutes of this meeting. Commission was in full agreement that any court which applies this rule of construction in these situations is crazy.
And in 1999, when some law clerk in Spalding's office goes back to this tape to check the legislative history, he's going to be appalled by that.
I think really what it is really the situation that I think it's clear that Bert said that what we're talking about by other means is other methods used with the intent to avoid payment. And there's nothing that this commission can do in any of these statutes that we're going to reflect the attitude of the court of whether they're going to grant a judgment of acquittal on you or not on this type of thing. If the court is going to be unduly restrictive upon the state, there's not a thing this commission can do. And if the courts are going to try to view the statute with the intent of the statute, well, this is what we want, but I don't think there's anything this commission can do to make the court...
Well, we might, in some other article, take care of it, but we're spending a lot of time on this, and we've got a long ways to go.
Yeah. Is there other discussion? Did I hear a motion?
I move we approve the circulation subsection.
Is there a second?
Did you say two? Just
the
whole shebang?
No, we've already approved one, and now we're on sub two.
Might I raise one question before you do?
With respect to subsection two.
Yeah. 2B. Commercial benefit. I noticed that New York says commercial is a rather substantial benefit. Is there any problem with commercial benefit? The boss is away and I get my secretary to send out 10,000 Christmas cards for me. And then commercial benefit. Is there a problem there? I don't know. I don't even make a big thing out of it.
Let the dog ask.
Well, that's, of course, as the minutes will show, that's probably the one other subsection in this draft that received the most attention. Was that question, and without reading through all the minutes, I would like to say that we did discuss this, and we talked about leaving substantial in there, and then we felt there was a construction problem there and a definition problem of what we mean by substantial. We finally settled on the use of just the commercial benefit. And commercial benefit was intended to differentiate this from the kind of conduct where there is a using of the property by someone who's an employee of someone else or something, but it's of such an insignificant character it shouldn't come to the attention of criminal law.
I think the employee should be fired rather than prosecuted.
Yeah, there were some things we thought we should leave to the employer to take care of.
I think this was fit under Don Clark's idea that you should make everybody's son. I agree with the
ready for the question, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passed. Now, with respect to subsection 3, which I won't read, which I discussed the opposite of this section, is there any discussion?
I just get the question that really are any of these services that you talk about, hotel, really, is it customary that these things be paid immediately upon receiving them? No, not until you're ready to check out of the hotel, customarily do you pay.
But you're
Did you read the minutes?
Time to check out.
There's quite a discussion on that very thing.
This is where we got into this about finding out
And one question, one hypothetical that was raised at the subcommittee meeting was, well, what about the individual who doesn't pay his landlord his monthly rent? Is that going to be theft of services under this? And the feeling was no, because this isn't the kind of accommodation you usually pay for immediately upon receiving it. Such as
well,
a hotel accommodation.
It would be my feeling that if you if the requisite intent was there and could be proven that a person moved in never in intending whatsoever to pay for it, that this might come within this statute. It wouldn't come within the prima facie.
Yeah, that's
right.
That's
right. It would come within it.
It wouldn't come under sub 3.
It wouldn't rise to the dignity of prima facie evidence, and we wanted to very narrowly restrict that conduct which would rise to the dignity of prima facie evidence. And so, as Don said, this is going to be narrowly applied. And the minutes fully recite that, and I should think will constitute legislative history. I'm going to call a recess after we approve this third subsection. Is it further? Discussion. George?
Yes, may I suggest the deletion of four words? Does hotel, restaurant, or other really help here? May it not be shortened by simply saying to pay for services for which compensation is customarily paid?
Then it seems to me that it broadens it, because the Diamond Fuel Company or Call Oil Company will say Burns didn't pay for his gas that was delivered to his house when it was delivered to him, and therefore we're entitled to a criminal complaint. And I'll say, well, I ordinarily pay for that at the end of the month. And they say, no, you customarily pay for that when you get the fuel.
Well,
isn't that wrong?
A little inconsistent then, Mr. Chairman. You're now applying justum generis in your favor in the narrow sense, whereas before we have been applying or suggesting it be applied in the broad sense.
I think here, this, as the minutes fully reflect, this reflects a real policy decision. And I personally think the subcommittee made the widest policy decision, not sweeping into the net a whole bunch of offenses that, or a whole bunch of conduct that shouldn't be bothering the criminal courts. And you have the same problem with construction here by using the term other, but I think that it is, the minutes reflect an intent to control a fairly narrow set of circumstances, and I think that's a wise decision. And I would certainly oppose removing those four words, because I think it inevitably, especially given the legislative history in the minutes, would broaden it so that Paul Oil or any of the others could come in and make that kind of claim.
Mine would be my thought.
I have one other question I'd like to raise very briefly, and I take it as thoroughly as I believe it, that when you say prima facie evidence, you merely intend to get beyond the directed verdict point. Once this is proved, then it's a jury question. It depends on the validity of the defense that's asserted, and it's in the hands of the jury. In this narrow class of cases, absconding without paying is sufficient to create a jury question.
That's correct.
Isn't that what you
that's
correct.
Correct.
That's correct.
That's correct.
Yeah. That generally, in a prima facie evidence situation, is used to set the very minimum that needs to be proved in those type of cases where you where direct proof is very difficult to show. So they set up a statutory prima facie case to make a minimum situation to make it a question for the jury to determine. Aren't we in this, by this statute, kind of setting up a almost a maximum as our prima facie case. Or are we?
By what Judge Burns says exactly, in the Oregon civil law, there's a real complex situation in a death by suicide case as to what a rebuttable presumption is. You don't mean rebuttable presumption in that sense here. You mean just enough to get to the jury.
Because in one of the early drafts, the word presumption was used
yes.
in this particular place, and thank goodness it was taken out because okay. this solves so many problems. Move to adopt subsection 3.
Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. Subsection 3 adopted. Let's have a 10-minute recess.
Is that all right?
You just did.
5-minute recess.
Is that right, Mr. Chairman?
In the definition of burglary. Now, it's
for the purposes of the definition section, it's a little difficult to relate this to the draft without reading the subsequent sections to see how these definitions are then employed.
I agree, and I think if nobody has any objections, what we should do is go to the substantive sections, get into them, and then if there are questions to relate back to the definition, we can go back.
Section 2 on page 5 of your preliminary draft number 2, further in the second degree. And here we have the word building used. And of course, building could mean a vehicle or a boat or an aircraft. Structure designed for overnight accommodation of persons or for carrying on business therein. He enters or remains. Now, enter or remain unlawfully means to enter or remain upon premises. Of course, premises then is defined in sub 2 of section 1, which includes the building and any real property. Of course, that definition becomes important when we look at trespass. Enter or remain in or upon premises when the premises at the time are not open to the public and when the actor is not otherwise licensed or privileged to do so. So, under section 2, burglary in the second degree could be committed if the defendant entered, he could conceivably enter lawfully but remain unlawfully. Accompanied by the requisite intent to commit a crime, you get away from the problem of whether or not he had an intent to commit the crime when he entered the building. It becomes immaterial. If he is remaining unlawfully, as that term is defined, and he has the requisite intent to commit a crime, he would be guilty of burglary in the second degree.
But not necessarily, it has to be a building.
It has to be a building.
Which yes. Includes a dwelling, but yes. Not necessarily premises.
Yes, so he could, if the building was a dwelling, but the crime was committed in the daytime, it would be burglary in the second degree.
What we've done is, presently we have a burglary in a dwelling and a burglary not in a dwelling statute. And the BNID is a 10-year, then the BID is a 15-year. And we combine this because we, in effect, have to be gone. Because we're saying if you commit burglary in whatever kind of building it is in the daytime, whether it's a dwelling or whether it's a business building, the second degree, and it rises to the dignity of first degree only if the act of burglary is accompanied by the additional factors that we recite first degree, right?
Right.
Now, this is a policy determination that subcommittee made, which the commission should be perfectly aware of, but please note that in our definition of building, section 1, sub 1, we define building as a structure adapted for overnight accommodation of persons or carrying on business therein. Now, this probably doesn't, this probably wouldn't include a shelter out at Silver Creek Falls Park, but if that sort of place was broken into, it would be covered by our criminal mischief section.
Would it include a warehouse?
Yes. But it wouldn't question whether it probably wouldn't cover a telephone booth, but such as
well, your enter or remain unlawfully is going to include telephone booths either. That section. has a telephone booth that we're ordinarily open for, I mean, all 24 hours a day. So you've taken it out from that sense.
Right. You might argue that a telephone booth would be adapted for carrying on business there.
In fact, you've taken out almost all the constructive breaking and everything else today.
The constructive breaking, we felt that the definition of entering or remaining, the remaining unlawfully, gets you away from the problem of your constructive breaking. You don't need to show a breaking, constructive or otherwise. The question is,
well, if that is, if it's the type of place that ordinarily closes up at some time, but if it doesn't, if it never closes, then like a telephone booth,
a laundromat.
Yeah, a laundromat. You can't commit burglary in a laundromat by going in. You can commit other crimes by stealing in there, and this type of thing, but you can't commit burglary by going into a laundromat. Stealing.
That's right.
You mean under this proposal?
Yeah.
Why not?
Because you cannot, you've got to enter or remain unlawfully, you see.
And that means entering or remaining in or upon premises at the time of such as when they're not open to the public and you're not otherwise licensed. But if you have water mats that's closed and locked up,
yeah,
and went into it, that's one thing. But where it was open and you went in, I would think we'd come within our criminal tampering.
Of course, that depends on what the individual does.
Yeah, what he does when he gets in there, you see. I mean, that's, it seems to me what this proposed statute does, it gets away from the constructive breaking and entering that they do say, okay, even though you didn't actually open a door or anything like this to get in, to actually have the breaking in, that even though you walk through an open door, if you walk in with the requisite intent.
I don't think it even goes that far.
Suppose you go into a laundromat and pry open the back of the coat machine and take the coins out. Is that a burglary?
In an open laundromat?
One that's
open to the public. You just walk right through the front door.
Yeah.
And,
I think under this draft is not.
No, I don't think it would be.
Under the present interpretation, it is.
Under the present law, it is.
Yeah, under the present law, it is burglary. That is, if you enter.
You don't want to make that burglary or criminal trespass.
Well, we have. We haven't done so.
You're going to put that into the criminal tampering?
Well, we didn't think that it rose, that act would rise to the dignity of perjury.
Now, that particular act could be tampering, but it could also be theft, too. I mean, if he opens it up and takes money out of the coke machine, it's going to be committing theft.
Well, I think that it seemed like this organization that was going on throughout the state here with their machines, that they could go into telephone booths, you know, just take out the no problem. I mean, this was a serious enough offense type thing that it should have been treated as burglary, and so the Supreme Court found that it is burglary. Because, I mean, it certainly, otherwise it would be petty larceny for an organized gang like this. Certainly it should be something more serious than that. And, I really don't feel that we should necessarily take that out of it, the burglary statute, where, I mean, like the Supreme Court said, when they entered this thing with this machine, entered a telephone booth with this machine, that they could just rip the guts out of the booth. Well, if they entered, they weren't privileged to enter under those circumstances.
Well, I'm not sure that I know how to analyze the thing adequately, but one of the chief criticisms of burglary statutes that they've developed is that you keep sweeping more things in them until eventually any larceny type crime or any attempted larceny type crime, which takes place in any kind of a structure, becomes burglary. And this
this everything is burglary, more or less there. But now you're suggesting that the present law is that if you enter a building, no matter whether it's at a time when you're legally allowed to enter, that if you have the criminal intent when you enter, that this is a breaking of
that. This was the objection of the dissent in that case, that the person walks into the courthouse knowing that he's going to commit perjury when he testifies, he's committing the crime of burglary entering the courthouse. Well, I mean, yeah, this is
the State versus Keys.
Yes.
And I think the law should not go that far. I think it should have something to take care of the telephone booth situation as a serious crime, but I don't think
we should. Well, here's the situation that we, the decision state that we thought that we provided for by going the way we've gone. A situation where it's 24 hour longer than that, I go in there with intent to steal, I get in there lawfully because it's open and there's no constructive breaking, I go in the back and I jimmy open the coin machine, and assume I don't get money, all right? If I have committed crime and burglary, then I've committed either criminal mischief in the third degree or in the second degree, because criminal mischief there that says that a person commits crime and criminal mischief in the third degree if with intent to cause substantial inconvenience to the owner or to another person and having no right to do so on a reasonable ground to believe that he has such right, he tampers or interferes with the property of another. That's third degree criminal mischief. It rises to the dignity of second degree if by doing that I damage the property in an amount exceeding $100. That's more, in other words, if I jimmy open this and damage the amount of $100 in the second degree. Or if I get money, then I fall within the provisions of our theft statute. So, but I don't commit the crime of burglary, which today I would be.
Well, I think, really, the reason why I mention it is that I think that the serious situation that Keys and this crew was involved in can probably be taken care of in another type of statute, which we really don't have at the present time, well, in some type of a criminal syndicate, an organization involved in various criminal activities. Might be able to catch this to make this a serious crime that it should be, where they've got a real organization that's operating doing this type of thing. Might be able to be covered in that type of thing. It wouldn't be necessary to have to fictionalize and bring it into burglary to make it as serious as it actually is. Is that conceivable?
Yes. And in line with this, Mr. Chairman, if I might just inquire generally of the members. Feeling that we need a separate statute, a separate criminal statute to relate to parking meters, coin telephones, and such things as that.
Hope you suggested.
Well, you've got all kinds of self-service things like car washes and filling stations. I was just wondering if maybe you could solve that by what would be a policy declaration by stating, rather than attempting to specifically define or classify it, by saying that in the commentary that I'm sure will be all of these sections, that it either is or is not intended that the decision in State versus Keys would be burglary or not burglary, but instead would be theft or criminal mischief, whatever you decide it should be. But put it as a commentary of the commission's intent, rather than trying to specifically define all these kinds of unoccupied or self-service types of structures. There is, as Art said, considerable disagreement with the kind of thing that was decided in the State versus Keys. In a sense, it's policy decision. You can either say you do want to follow this or you don't.
How could we say that State versus Keys applied if we left the definition of enter or remain unlawfully?
Well, I assume you could do it by in the definition of a building. carrying on a business there, yeah. The carrying on a business therein is intended to include the kind of situation as expressed in State versus Keys, or words to that effect.
So that question of the telephone booth is open 24 hours a day.
Yeah, you can.
It's long before you enter. And I argue we shouldn't go so far to say that merely entering with a subjective criminal intent without more should create vertigo.
And that's what State versus Keys held.
Yeah.
Well, very definitely held.
And I think that it's in the definition of enter or remain unlocked before we throw out.
Before
we throw out keys rather than, you know, definition of building.
There's some kinds of destructive breaking that you're not throwing out. The idea of I get up on your porch at night and roll a barrel of cans down to the front, you come out and look around and I sneak in behind you. Now, we're not tampering with that.
No, we're not changing that. What we're talking about is a building that is ordinarily open to the public that you could say that at any time, except for the fact that you were going to commit a crime there and entered with the intent to commit a crime there, it would have been perfectly lawful for you to be there. My interpretation of enter or remain unlawfully would cover the situation where a guy goes into a grocery store and then goes back into a storeroom and hides and waits until the place is closed down and comes out then and hits the safe. He's committed burglary.
He has
under this.
But the vice is for privilege to do what he did.
Right. But the telephone booth, the other places that are open, well, let's say,
would the penalty sections take care of that situation? He would either he'd be committing some other present time under this. It would not be burglary, as I see it.
Yeah.
But it could be theft.
Maybe I should get cleared up here. Wouldn't State versus Keys be second degree burglary under this proposal?
No.
I don't see how it could.
Why not?
Because here is a building. It's not a vehicle, boat, aircraft, or other structure adapted for overnight accommodation of persons or for carrying on a business therein. And it's not separate units.
Nor does it fit five.
And five, enter or remain, that's the only other one that's applicable. Because at the time such entry or remain are not open to the public, it is open to the public. And the actor is not otherwise licensed or privileged to do so. He's licensed
to carry on. It's not a building for the carrying on a business.
I would say that it would be.
District attorney right next to me that's already argued that.
I think you could argue that, right? But when you get to five, when you get to the definition of entering or remaining unlawfully.
Yeah. Entering or remaining unlawfully, he's not committing burglary.
You've got to show two things. You've got to show that they're not open to the public and he's not otherwise licensed or privileged to.
If it is open to the public and you're not privileged or licensed to enter or remain as you do, then you would enter or remain unlawfully.
That's what Keyes said.
And so if a telephone booth situation, which is open to the public, is the situs of the crime, the court very well might say, well, sure, it's open to the public, but he wasn't privileged to enter or remain in there as he did, because he had the subjective criminal intent of
But we use the term in Section 5, the definitions are not open to the public and, you see, if it's an or,
conjunct.
We might still get the Keyes situation into it. But when we say and, I mean, you're going to have to prove not only that it's not open to the public, and further, that he didn't have a reasonable, otherwise have a reason basically that he was licensed or privileged to be there.
Second degree is enters or remains unlawfully.
Your criminal tampering statute, that is parking meters and...
Well, that would cover this situation we're talking about.
Well, couldn't we just, by penalty, take care of this thing?
That's what I was thinking about.
In that tampering statute? If it's considered a severe crime to do these, can't we still cover it under tampering and just
up the degree or whatever it might be.
Or we could change that conjunctive to disjunctive at the end, or.
I think there are problems covering the burglary statute.
But what we were trying to get at here, and what I think all the modern revisions are trying to do, is stop calling something burglary that really isn't burglary.
Yeah, and
pull it back into some reasonable limits and say, in fact, some of the commentary I read indicates they thought about changing the name of the crime completely and just do away with calling it burglary. Because but they felt that it's so firmly entrenched in our law, the idea of burglary, particularly burglary in a dwelling, that you might create more problems than you solve. But really what we're trying to get at is the kind of invasion of premises that's likely to terrorize occupants, whether these premises are business premises or dwelling houses, this type of thing. This is our basic rationale for crime and burglary.
It's not necessarily completely just the terrorizing of people, it's the sanctity of property that you've got a building there, a structure there that nobody has a right to come in, break in, and steal. It's the building as well as the property.
Well, of course,
and as a personal.
That's evolved by statute.
Yeah. Well, this is true, but.
99% of all arson are committed in villages. That make all arson burglary. In fact, we've come to that with keys, it seems to me. An 18-year-old girl walked in the store to shoplift a 50-cent item. Changed her mind after they did it because she walked into the subject of intentions first.
Well, the way that they took care of that was that, let's say that if a person entered the store with the false bottom purse or shopping bag or something, then you could say that it would probably be burglary because that's a very serious shoplifter and that type of thing. But the girl who just goes in with nothing but just snatches the candy bar, I mean this, of course you might be able to argue that she had the intent to steal at the time she entered and this type of thing, that at least in my view doesn't come within the burglary situation. But a key, they said, you know, they had the machines to rip out the guts of the telephone.
There's a degree of proof, though, isn't really giving the law.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know whether we're talking as much about the definition as we are about second-degree burglary, but they're in at least in terms of how the second-degree burglary statute is worded. Without regard to the definition, does anybody see any problems with regard to that?
Let me ask this question: What would it be if you broke into a beach house or a cabin?
Well, it's a that overnight accommodation person. It would be second degree burglary unless you were armed, caused physical injury, threaten the use of a dangerous weapon, or did it at night. Then it would be first degree.
If you found it in the dwelling, would it automatically be a dwelling?
Yes. Because of the work use of the word adapt. Adapt for overnight accommodation.
I'm curious about what the difference would be between a building, inspector adapted for overnight, and the building usually occupied by a person lodging there in at night. Is there a difference? I'm sure you mean a difference, but I wonder if there is one there.
Well, for example, under building, you can have a, say, a trailer house adapted for overnight accommodation, but it might not usually be occupied. But if you've got a trailer house that's usually occupied, then that would come under the definition of dwelling. But in any event, it would be a building, whether it's usually occupied or not, if it were in fact adapted for overnight accommodation persons.
Let me answer the question, or supplement that. If it's a building that's used for carrying on business, and the breaking and entering occurs at nighttime, it's still second degree. It's only first degree
with respect to nighttime if it relates to the well.
Could you build from the mom and pop store?
All right, yeah, if they're sleeping in the back. But I go out and burglarize the warehouse in the nighttime, second degree burglary, because in our first degree definition, we subsection 2, we phrase it in the conjunctive.
Well, it could be first degree, though, if you had one of the other enhancing provisions.
Yeah, yeah, right.
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 But what if you go out onto Union Avenue and break into a house trailer that's for sale there, in a obviously an unoccupied situation?
With an intent to commit a crime?
Yeah, you're going to get it.
I think the law of dwelling doesn't become a dwelling until somebody who lived in it.
I think the common law of the courtroom is very common law
today. There, I think, we come into the definition of dwelling. Dwelling means a building which is usually occupied by a person. So I think there that if it's on a lot, it would be in a different situation than your cabin. Now, maybe I'm making a distinction without a difference.
Has it just become dwelling?
Oh, what about a use trailer?
Well, when it's on the lot, it's usually
is it a structure that's
usually
that's adapted for overnight accommodation?
It would be a building, but not a dwelling.
Isn't that what you're trying to achieve? You don't want to make it a dwelling.
But if it's
a trailer in a trailer park and people usually occupy it at night, then it's a dwelling.
Right.
Even though they've gone to San Francisco for the weekend.
Not sure.
There's some esoterics here, but I think they relate to a basic problem. I'm going to raise it in another connection. This relates to the mistake of fact defense. Now, with respect to the dwelling, when you say a dwelling is a building usually occupied. Now, does that mean the kind of building is usually occupied, or the specific building that's entered?
Specific. Because the other would be up in sub 1 at that.
But like the corner grocery store, I mean, if somebody's living in the building, if they live in the back and sleep there, it's a dwelling. So well, the person knows it at the time he breaks in or not. It doesn't make any difference.
We're going to run in, I know. We're going to run into some police agents with respect to the way that we alter this burglary section.
On what basis?
Well, on the basis that we only make burglary of the dwelling first degree if it occurs at night, for example.
Yeah, that's
probably the major area. We have an increasing number of house burglaries in the daytime. But
the potential danger is not there. You can find it not.
That's exactly terror. That's the rationale behind the subcommittee's
That is not there.
Raises the point that I was going to bring out with respect to nighttime. The actual arbitrary element that becomes appears to be a material element of the crime by saying that it can break in 30 minutes after sunset, which tonight is 8:40, let's say, you're committing first-degree burglary. The burglar, the professional, very carefully plans to enter that house in the daytime because he knows about the crime, the offense being more serious at nighttime, but mistakes the time on his watch. He has a clear criminal intent to commit burglary in the daytime, not in the nighttime. This again raises the problem of mistake of fact.
It's not a defense.
Which is going to be a
mistake of fact or not.
Well, isn't it going to be more of a defense under the model penal code approach? And if it is a defense, what does it do?
The conduct that's a great situation. That's a limited situation.
But we enact the code for the protection of the
right. Well, what I'm suggesting is
the victim, and the reason that we employing the arbitrary nighttime provision is because when it occurs at night, it increases the risk to the victim, ostensibly.
It increases not only the risk, but the terror to the occupants.
Well,
and there are other considerations, too, the difficulty of identifying the
I make a suggestion only that the nighttime be eliminated from this crime. The entry of a dwelling with intent to commit a crime ought to be first degree burglary.
Right.
And that we eliminate any problem with the technical, arbitrary nature of the material element of the crime being at what time the entry occurred. I think that it's unnecessarily, the assumption is unnecessarily made that there's less terror in the daytime, there's less threat to the sanctity of the home and the safety of the housewife, excuse me, the situation, than at night. As a matter of fact, you could argue that if one of the reasons given here was for burglary at night because making it more severe because identification is more difficult, that in the daytime then it would be to the criminal's advantage to become violent to prevent his identification because he is more visible in the daytime. That there might be more violence result. I mean, this is it's an argument, I don't know how good it is, but it could be made.
It seems to me, I mean, this is just from my standpoint as a district attorney and problems of proof and dealing with it at a time of trial, that unless you have a situation where the homeowner went to bed and his house was intact, and he got up in the morning and the house had been broken into and stuff taken, you're not going to have first degree burglary. You're not going to be able to prove it. You're going to have second degree burglary. Even though the burglary may have occurred at midnight, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning.
You're not going to be able to prove that it occurred.
At night. You're going to have unnecessary trials over the question as to whether or not it's the homeowner left his home at, say, at 6 o'clock. He came back at 10 o'clock. Okay, when did that occur? You're going to have to be calling your meteorologist or whatever you want to call him every burglary trial to show when sunset was. It seems to me a dwelling is a type of a building that should be sacred and should have the protection regardless of whether it's 8:45 or 9:45.
Seems to me that in those cases you try them on the lesser degree where you didn't know. At the same time, I'm much more concerned and much more fearsome of being asleep at night and having somebody break in and walk around and run the possibility of coming out and bludgeoning me in my bed than I am of the burglar who carefully waits till everybody leaves the house in the morning and comes up and busts the back window, goes in and steals the TV set. I'm much less fearsome than him. I think he's a much more safe person than the guy who's wandering around at night not knowing whether the dwelling's occupied or not.
Well, Frank, don't think that you're hypothetical where you have a burglary that's occurred between the hours you stated, that don't you think as a prosecutor you go for first degree and try to prove and put what proof you had on to narrow down the time the burglary as close as possible anyway?
You probably would. But
I mean, you would not automatically just go to second degree.
You have enough time for some burglary.
You probably knock your head against the wall once or twice, and then maybe you'd wise up. And it's my feeling that we, if we are only, as Don says, the person who's going to come up and really hurt somebody inside or this type of thing, that the causes or attempts to cause physical injury to any person inside the house, this covers it in first degree. So let's not let's take burglary with dwelling. Let's take it completely out. I mean, let's leave it just the same as what would be second degree burglary.
Mildred can make arrangements for us to eat down in the blue room, presidential suite, I think. Do you all want to disperse here at 12:30 and go your own ways, or if it's raining, you want to get the room down into the coffee shop and eat down there? We're going to resume at 1:30, and I thought we'd go to 12:30. What do you prefer to do?
I just think we're downstairs.
It's
mm-hmm.
a good idea. I've got to be away. I've got another appointment at 1 o'clock.
Okay. Or we could just eat in the
room. We can just eat down there informally, and if you want to do that, I don't know. We
can
still
get the. I don't know if we could get it now, but I can try if you want to.
Because there aren't too many of us.
Well, if we want to eat together, we can get a table at the thing.
Yeah.
All right. Professor Arnold.
Well, I was just going to say, I've got to be away at 1 o'clock. That's why I couldn't eat down there.
Well, you think then, Frank, that just delete dwelling completely for first degree?
No. My position is, and my feeling is that burglary of a dwelling should be first degree burglary regardless of when it occurs.
We know.
If we're not going to have it be first degree regardless, I feel that it would be better. I mean, if this is a policy decision that the commission wants to make, I think we just as well put it into the second degree burglary statute and be done with it, rather than raise all these complications.
What do you think, Pastor?
I don't know. I have a notion. Question: whether you want to make first degree, make a dwelling entry first degree under any circumstance. I haven't really thought about it, frankly. I just don't know. I see good reasons for both pro and con.
The Model Penal Code follows this line of reasoning. They make it felony in the second degree if it's in the dwelling of another at night, or if he's inflicts or attempts to inflict bodily injury or is armed with explosives or a deadly weapon. Otherwise, burglary is a felony in the third degree. That's under the Model Penal Code version. The burglary in the first degree under New York, it's first degree if it's a dwelling at night.
What is first degree in the Model Penal Code?
First degree in the Model Penal Code is...
Well, there isn't any.
You can say it first degree of the Model Penal Code.
I might mention that the New York version of first degree, you have to show not only that it was a dwelling at night, but also, then you have to go on to show that he, plus one of these other things, he's armed, or he caused injury, or he threatens to use a dangerous instrument. So, the degree of proof would be much greater under the New York version of first degree burglary than it would under ours.
I want to say this. My reaction is, my personal reaction in the subcommittee, and I was outvoted, was in line with Professor Pratt's initial suggestion that we amend first degree subsection 3 by putting a period after dwelling. And by way of rebuttal, I guess, to Don Chark's observation, and of course, you can rebut this on from your experience, but the Portland Police Burglary officers tell me that, in their judgment, the single biggest factor that they encounter in connection with house burglaries is the terror that it puts in the mind of the housewife, generally. And this terror is generally as